everyone. Thank you for being here. Last week, I got the chance to tour Main Street, Ellicott City, and witness firsthand the tremendous progress that County Executive Kittleman and his team, together with our state agencies, have the tremendous progress that they've made in cleaning up and repairing and rebuilding after the flood damage. And it was really encouraging to see so many stores and restaurants that were reopening. We had the opportunity to honor many of the heroes from the flood. Not only there were so many, you know, stories and acts of heroism, not only that first night, but in the days that followed, and citizens who worked tirelessly to help their neighbors clean up. We awarded the folks that banded together in the human chain to save the woman from the car. Everybody's seen that video, of course, but also those who organized and made food deliveries and volunteers who helped clean up the debris and those who donated their time and their organizational skills to plan and help fund some of the recovery. But all of them were Marylanders working together to help their neighbors and coming together in the face of tragedy to help their fellow citizens. And I just wanted to say Ellicott City's come a very long way since that tragic situation in July. There's still a whole lot more to be done, but I'm very pleased with the progress. I have no doubt that by continuing to work together and everybody pitching in and helping out, that Ellicott City's future will be even brighter and better than its incredibly significant and historic past. So at this point, I'd like to turn the floor over to my colleagues for any opening comments. Treasurer.
Governor, good morning. It's a pleasure to be here. I, too, without the escort, happened to go to Ellicott City, and I was very, very impressed. And it shows what a community can do when they come together. It also points out, I believe, a serious need in planning both at the state and local level with an eye towards the impact. I see the secretary nodding. The impact and adaptation to changes in the climate, this radical increase in what we now call nuisance floods, right? A term nobody even heard of a few years ago, which are just indicative of an infrastructure like a sewer system or like the large expanses of impervious surface, which simply are not created to contain the waters and the forces that are coming. And I was pointing out to a class at school last week, you know, you think the waters are coming, you want to jump in because summer's over and this is an opportunity. But it's not just clean, potable water that's coming. This is a serious health hazard. And so I'm glad and I'm looking forward to hearing from the Department of Natural Resources and the rest of the cabinet about how we're dealing with adaptation to this changing climate. Governor, I was just going to mention there are three very significant items, I believe, on the agenda today. The first one, I believe, dealing with the state budget. We were talking to the rating agencies in New York, and I think they understand that Maryland has an outstanding process for dealing with problems like the one we face now, one where the revenue estimates came in low. The governor sent in a budget in the last session that was underspending affordability. The legislature cut it even more, ended session with a reduced budget, a rainy day fund over $1 billion and a significant surplus. And then we started seeing the revenue estimates come in a small percentage below the anticipated, but a small percentage in a very large budget is a good amount of money. And this governor, like his predecessors, we're now facing the need to cut and cut as early in the year as possible to spread across the pain for a whole year instead of just waiting until the 11th month and then doing what you have to do. Meanwhile, the world's economy and the nation's is in flux. we are, in case somebody has been sleeping for the last couple of months, in a time of volatility, and will be a little longer. And we'll just be keeping an eye on those revenue estimates. But I think, as I said, this I just wanted to point out that this shows the strength of a system that is able to respond to needs and that budgets prudently. We hope we won't have to go into that $1 billion rainy day fund. We never have. But it's there, and I think the folks who invest in us know that and appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Counselor.
Thank you, Governor, and good morning, Madam Treasurer. Last week, my office held a job fair in Baltimore City, which drew hundreds of job seekers from across that region. In a two-hour span, over 700 Marylanders stood in the rain, 6 p.m. to 8 p.m., 700 individuals, to a person, talented, energetic. Many of them had been in the military. All of them needed a job. So I could not have been more pleased to be there, not just with my own agency, because we are hiring people, but the governor allowed seven or six of his agencies, the Department of Budget Management, Department of General Services, Department of Public Safety, and Correctional Services, the Department of Juvenile Services, and the Department of Human Resources, to join with us. And, Governor, thank you for that, because, trust me, it had a very, very positive response. We're going through hundreds of resumes from the what I believe were a pool of highly qualified job seekers, and obviously the governor's agencies will be looking also for their own needs. We're going to have another job fair on November 15th at the Humanin Building in Baltimore. The first one was the C.C. Jackson Community Center in Baltimore's Park Heights. Trust me, that is an area that's economically challenged. And frankly, the rec center was too small. So the next job fair is going to be a bigger location. And we're going to reach out, try to do the right thing. And not only the state agencies, but the Baltimore Mayor's Office of Employment Development and also not-for-profits like Maryland New Directions were there. And they provided valuable resources and information to attendees and my staff. I want to thank my staff for organizing it. We had no idea it would have such a large turnout. And, Governor, I think that's just a reminder to us that all of us have a lot of work to do to continue the progress towards full employment. And we're doing better. And, obviously, we have to weather some of the uncertain economic times. But I think today's significant action by the board underscores the continued challenges that the state faces with our economy and revenue outlook. And it reinforces the need for caution and fiscal prudence as we make tough decisions on how to best spend Marylanders' hard-earned tax dollars. And if I could, just as a point of personal privilege, make a comment about the fact that the elections are going to be held next Tuesday. I want to remind our citizens that we are Americans and we are Marylanders way in front of being Democrats or Republicans. And I am just appalled at the toxic partisanship that each side has demonstrated. And it is obviously of great concern to me, because somebody's going to have to, after next Tuesday, put our country back together again. And it's not going to be done by the professional politicians who have torn it apart. It's going to be done by people in the communities who work together, whose kids go to the same school, who live in the same communities. It's all of us that are going to have to remind ourselves that we have a common identity. And Governor's Republican, I'm a Democrat, but I think, and the Treasurer's a Democrat, but I think everybody realizes that there's been a lot of damage that's been done, and we're going to have a lot of hard work putting things back together. Just wanted to say that to get it off my chest, Governor.
Yeah. You feel better?
Yeah, I do feel better.
Thank you.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much. Normally, we start off with the Secretary's agenda, but as I think most people know, we have a very important item on the budget and management agenda, item 11, which we'd like to take up first. So we're going to start with the DBM agenda, and then we'll go back to the regular agenda order. The Board of Public Works is vested with important budgetary authority, and today it is necessary for us to exercise that authority. Unfortunately, due to unsustainable forced increases in spending, the state has simply been spending more than it takes in. So we need to take some immediate actions to be more fiscally responsible, and we will be continuing to monitor revenues and to see if we will have to take further actions again in the near future. But we've all seen the latest revenue estimates and the spending affordability report, and while our 3% revenue growth is fairly healthy, the rate of spending, even under the rosiest of assumptions, still outpaces what the state brings in to the tune of about $250 million a year. So even the legislature's own budget officer, Warren Deschenaux, is raising serious concerns about this chronic problem in his briefings to legislative budget leaders, telling them that they need to, quote, get real about the state's unaffordable spending problem. Our budget secretary strongly agrees with that assessment, and so does everyone else in our administration. Reforming Maryland's budget process in order to stop spending more than the state takes in has been a top priority of ours since day one of our administration almost 21 months ago, which is why we work so hard to eliminate 90% of the $5.1 billion structural deficit in our first budget. It's why we pushed to increase the rainy day fund to over $1 billion. It's why we proposed common sense reform to help free us from the handcuffs of having 83 cents of every single state dollar be mandated spending increases. Our administration saw the potential for this budgetary shortfall on the horizon, which is why we refused to spend the $80 million in additional money that the legislature had fenced off and has been trying to force us to spend. Not spending that money was the right decision. Had we done so, the shortfall would have been $80 million worse than it is today. Not spending that additional $80 million was simply step one. The budget actions that we're proposing today, and which Secretary Brinkley will detail for us in just a moment, represent the second step in taking actions to put us on the right course to address the realities of this fiscal year's revenue picture. So with that, I'll turn it over to Secretary Brinkley.
Governor, could I just interrupt to say what said before? Thank you. Well, sometimes one feels one has to. Just to remind folk, and I don't believe the Secretary would disagree, that the budget that you submitted and that was later cut by the General Assembly, when it was enacted, in fact, did address the structural deficit in 16 and 17, created not only over $100 million in the rainy day fund, but a surplus. That, in fact, was the situation. We are now hit by a revenue shortfall. And, of course, there's always ongoing policy debate about where the fund should go and what department. I recognize that. That's not my role, whether it should be in corrections or education and housing or whatever and where it should be cut. But I wouldn't want folks to think that the budget was passed in deficit, or that the problem we face today at the moment is due to excess spending because there still is that surplus, but it is due to the revenue. We sit on the revenue board, to the revenue coming down, and we're going to have to deal with it, and you're dealing with it, and I hope this is the first bite, but I have a feeling, Governor, unfortunately, that it's probably not. And I hope we can all deal with it together and acknowledge the causes and not just turn this into a who struck John. The budget that the legislature passed, the governor's budget, the budget that everybody received was, in fact, a structurally balanced budget. But it depended on revenue that were too low to do it. Didn't materialize. Yeah. Yeah.
So. And thank you, Madam Treasurer. The other thing I want to point out before we hear from Secretary Brinkley is that we could be in a much worse situation.
Could be Virginia.
One of the things, yeah, it could be Virginia. One of the things that, you know, we've been focused on growing our economy, helping the private sector grow, helping businesses return to the state, expand in the state, create more jobs. We went from last place in the Mid-Atlantic region in job creation to first place. We added 76,000 private sector jobs. Our state economy in 2014 was ranked 49th out of 50 states. We're now number 11. It's the biggest economic improvement of any state in the United States of America. In spite of that, we have a national economy. We have, you know, headwinds that are making things difficult. And the revenues are not coming in as much as we would have expected. But if we had not taken all these other actions of improving our economy and reducing the deficit, we'd be in a really terrible situation. So.
Yeah.
It's reasonable, but we're going to address it, right, Mr. Secretary?
We are. We're in the midst of it. Thank you, Governor. And for the record, I'm David Brinkley, the Secretary of Budget and Management. Going off the normal script, we do have 11 items for today's agenda. Item 6S, OPT, is being withdrawn. I'll bring to your attention item 11, which is the supplemental and the topic of which we've been discussing. And Madam Treasurer, to some of your comments, yes, the budget that was passed was balanced. However, the legislature also increased our obligation in out years by increasing mandates to the tune of about $300 million over the past 2 years, which only contributes to the challenge that we have in front of us. And also, Madam Treasurer, as we had conversations earlier, the bond rating agencies are not so concerned with what we're doing. People in this room are concerned about what we're doing. They are just concerned that we are taking action to ensure that we shore up our finances. The public saw last week at the Spending Affordability Committee meeting a presentation of the short and the long-term budget challenges that the state faces. The Department of Budget and Management, Governor, is recommending to the governor to this board $82 million in general fund reductions, many of which are reductions to FY17 increases or they're reductions due to declining caseloads. This is the second responsible step to timely address some of the short-term budget issues we face, and as the governor referenced, the first was in not spending the $80 million of fund balance that was fenced off by the legislature. Again, I want to remind you that the vast majority of the reductions in front of you to the members of the board are either reductions to increases or they're reductions to declining caseloads or they're using non-general funds. The governor is proposing $82 million of general fund budget reductions across state government, including one-fourth of this amount, $20 million, is a reduction to Medicaid funding to be offset by an equivalent amount of cigarette restitution funds. The money is allowed to be used for that purpose. We have the money. Therefore, that's what we're going to do. $9.1 million is a reduction to the Department of Juvenile Services to reflect, again, a declining need for per diem funding for youth and residential placements. $4 million of the reduction is to the Selinger program, which still provides $46.8 million in the program, which is still a 9% increase over what was obtained in the previous fiscal year. $3.7 million is reduced in the temporary cash assistance payments, again, to reduce the declining caseload. $3.4 million to the homeowners tax credits to reflect lower estimated usage. There is still a remaining $60 million in that program. A $2 million reduction to the Cyber Maryland Investment Incentive Tax Credit Program to reflect weak demand for the funds and the use of the existing fund balance, which hasn't been used. Other budget actions will total $23 million. They can be implemented through the budget in January or the recognition of additional revenue, including up to $12 million in revenue from the Volkswagen settlement that was just declared last week. $9.8 million in reversions in environmental PAYGO funds that can and will be replaced in the FY18 capital budget. We'll be recognizing another $23 million in other balanced budgeting actions, nearly $10 million of which will be in agency reversions. So, Governor, we have people here to address certain questions that may or may not come up on this, and we're prepared to address any questions that you or the other members of the board might have.
Mr. Comptroller, any questions?
Yes, thank you, Governor. As chairman of the Board of Revenue Estimates, where I serve with the treasurer and the budget secretary, I am acutely aware of the context of these proposed budget reductions with respect to the fact that we wrote the revenues down. Treasurer Kopp and I sat through many meetings with the previous governor, frankly, and in this situation he proposed tough budget cuts in order to react to the fiscal realities of the state. I'm sure, as the treasurer can attest, today's actions really pale in comparison to the magnitude of the cuts, slightly over $2 billion, that's B as in boy, $2 billion that this unique Board of Public Works made in the depths of the Great Recession. So I continue to believe that this Board of Public Works, which is stands alone among the states with the power that's been vested in it, should make these tough but necessary fiscal decisions. And I believe it's a key reason why the financial community, as the Secretary said, continues to view Maryland favorably in terms of our ability to meet our financial obligations, even when we experience fiscal challenges. And the key is that this is in real time. This happens now. Other states don't have that nimbleness, I guess. I do have a couple of specific questions. My first question relates to the 113 positions at public higher ed institutions that appear slated to be eliminated as part of this proposal. According to our materials, it appears that all 12 positions at Morgan State and 60 out of the 101 positions at the University System of Maryland are currently vacant, but it also appears that 41 of those positions, more than a third of the total, are filled with people. So we have not been provided a list of these encumbered pins, but could someone explain to us what these positions are that we're talking about? And more importantly, who the people are who will be impacted? Specifically, is this part of a voluntary retirement program like the separation programs we've done throughout state government in the past, or are these actual layoffs? And were the individual institutions consulted as to what actions need to be taken?
Thank you, Mr. Comptroller. The university is here. Bob, you want to step up?
Great. Yeah, thank you for the opportunity to explain. When we were asked to put together our tentative proposal,
yourself.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Robert Corrett, Chancellor of the University System of Maryland. When we were asked back in September to put together a proposal on how cuts would be handled over the year, it was at a higher level than the cuts we are experiencing at the moment. It was a 2.5% cut of about $25 to $26 million. And as we put that plan together, it included eliminating vacant positions, layoffs. These were all rolled up through the campuses, so the campuses were involved in those discussions, operating cost cuts, and a potential mid-year tuition increase. At the level of this cut, we immediately took the stance that a tuition increase is not appropriate. It's not a cut that would warrant such a move, and that people should not be eliminated at a cut of this level. So we feel, given the size of the cut and also given the timing of the cut, because we didn't know if this cut would come in February, March, or April, if it did come, we have time to not only eliminate, obviously, the vacant positions, but to, through a hiring freeze, actually through attrition, eliminate the other positions as needed. So there will be no one eliminated from their position.
Excellent.
And is there a more finite listing that the comptroller asked for?
In terms of the individuals involved, I'm sorry?
There won't be any individuals.
Yeah.
No. The position.
In terms of the positions themselves, if we do it through attrition, it would, and through a freeze, it would be whatever positions obviously are available. The freezes would be temporary, but we could generate the funds that way.
Yeah. My understanding is you lose like 40-some people a month.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's correct.
31 total positions.
Yeah, we have about, I think, roughly 36 to 39,000 employees at any given moment. So it's a, yeah.
But this is, just one last question, based on history. This is a freeze over which you have some discretion.
That's correct, yeah.
So that if it's a position of significance.
As one of my mentors used to say, it's a hiring slush. We make the hiring much more difficult.
It's much more rational. Thank you.
Any other questions?
No, thank you, Mr. Chancellor. I do have another question on
could
the...
Could I just say, yeah, sure. I hope it goes on record, about a quarter of the first cut is higher education. They've taken, they've dealt with, but as we go further down the road, one would hope that that would be remembered and not keep going to the same well time after time. Mr. Nicole nods his head.
Well, I think the Chancellor appreciated us putting all that money in to buy down that tuition increase, and we appreciate his reciprocation in helping us solve this problem.
And the students very appreciative also.
That's right. Thank you.
Could I ask the Chancellor, since I've got him here, if you are contemplating a mid-year, not this year, mid-year tuition increase, would you be so good as to notify the 529 program, which pays for that, so we can be prepared?
We have Joe Vavona here who handles those, and we'll make sure that he does that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chancellor.
Thank you.
Right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chancellor. And keep up the great leadership.
Thank you.
And I just started a 529 program for my new granddaughter.
Right.
Good.
Yeah, 5 months old.
Brilliant investment.
Yes. And it's a great program. So I have a question about the $650,000 cut to the Children's Cabinet Interagency Fund. It appears as if this money is used by the governor's office for children for training, technical assistance to the local management boards in each county across the state. These LMBs, management boards, obviously provide crucial services to children and youth who are most at risk and the most vulnerable. I guess my question is, will this have any programmatic impact on actual service delivery for...
No, we don't believe it'll have any type of effect on the budget, Mark. Step up here for the details on it, but it's not going to have any direct impact on that. We noticed that they have, go ahead with the I think there's about $25,000 left over from before.
Good morning, members of the board. My name is Mark Nicole, Deputy Secretary, Department of Budget Management. Mr. Comptroller, this reduction was for funds, as you noted, that were identified for training and technical assistance. The agency had budgeted about $15,000 in fiscal year 17 for that. This reduction of $650,000 leaves $65,000 left, which is more than the $22,000 they spent in the previous year for training and technical assistance.
Okay, good. Thank you for that answer. I have two other quick questions. Apparently there's some proposed cuts to the capital appropriations within the Department of Housing and Community Development. These proposed cuts include adjustments to existing funding commitments, quote unquote. I assume we're not planning to renege on any of those commitments, but could someone explain to me how the reductions and the any anticipated impact?
Good morning, Ken Holt, Secretary of Housing.
Good morning, Mr.
Madam Treasurer, Governor, Mr. Comptroller. First of all, we stand firmly behind your fiduciary responsiveness to the state's budgetary needs, and we're going to do our share. Clearly, we have made commitments to our customers, and we're going to stand behind those commitments. We have the capability to do that because we generate cash from our financing activities, and that cash can be planned and unplanned. We are confident that we will have the ability to align our commitments with our cash flow. And we have made announcements about Community Legacy and Bernie. You're going to approve the Bernie awards today. And none of those commitments will be affected. We're very confident about our future. We've grown our top-line revenue significantly There are some exciting programs next year. So our sense is that we will have more revenue to be able to do more in the way of managing the needs of our citizens.
Thank you very much.
Let me just follow on what the comptroller, just to make sure, because I'm sure the comptroller and I heard from many of the same people.
Sure.
You're saying we can say to all of these people that, like Annapolis, like Community Legacy, like, I mean, just the whole list of them, that they are not going to be adversely impacted?
Correct.
Because of your...
Correct.
Okay. So, do you have a... do you have a form letter that you're sending out to them that you can share with us?
We certainly have the right response for them, and that is basically all of the awards that we have made and all of the awards that we are currently evaluating will be honored.
Okay. And,
no
and
doubt.
I believe you.
Okay.
I will tell them that you said that. You say in the explanation, I assume you write the explanation, Kenneth.
Yes, I did.
The program will be recalibrated or restructured. The program will be. Does this imply, I inferred from this that there actually was going to be a restructuring of, like, the rental housing program itself or homeowner. Is that what this means, or do you just mean
the... We're recalibrating the funding of the programs, not the programs.
Okay. So you anticipate, I'm just trying to understand what, because this sounds like a policy, as opposed to the things that are based on excess capacity or work. Is this a changing of any of the housing programs?
I think it's essentially a redeployment of our cash flow to meet our obligations, and we have the flexibility to do that. We finance over $500 million of lending projects on an annual basis. That gives us income and revenue, and there's fungibility to that revenue.
Yeah.
And through our contract admin and other sources, we just have enough in reserve to be able to meet these obligations.
And does this include the energy program, which looks like it's cut in half, but you can still do it?
Yeah, the net zero program, something that Senator Ron Young was quite interested in, had $1.5 million, and it's been reduced. We will be able to meet the obligations to construct net zero housing to that extent, to the $1.5 million extent.
And then after that, I assume it's a question of going into the governor and going into the legislature, and if you actually are restructuring, the way I read, restructuring the programs, that would be through law for the future?
Again, we're talking about restructuring the funding mechanisms for the programs, not refunding, not restructuring the programs themselves.
Okay, including the energy.
Including the energy. All of the programs that were listed, Community Legacy, Rental Housing Works, Home Ownership, Partnership Rental Housing, Energy Efficiency, and Special Loans.
Good work.
You know, I would take that and sit down if I were you.
Thank you.
Just a second. Good work.
Yeah.
Nice job.
Governor, I have one last question, if I could. DeWitt, the Department of Information Technology, apparently is getting a reduction of $803,000 for oversight of IT projects. Could someone just briefly explain what oversight is going to be scaled back as a result of this? I admit I'm a bit paranoid because I lie awake at night with all the hacking of government agencies, all of the threats associated with cyber attacks. But if you could assure me and others that we're not somehow exposing the taxpayers to any increased vulnerability from cyber threats, please.
Sure. I'm Luis Estrada, Deputy Secretary of the Department of IT. The major IT development project oversight dollars are not used for our cybersecurity mission. We would never make any cuts or make any changes to our programs to put the state in a more vulnerable position or systems and data that we're entrusted with.
Excellent.
Any further questions? Mr. Comptroller? No. Treasurer?
No, I'm trying my best to get along with all sides here, but I will just comment for the record that what we have in the state, and I served for 20 years on the Appropriations Committee, and we, you know, legislators are wonderful people. I was part of that budget process. We always defined our success, generally, not always, we generally defined our success by how much money we were spending compared to the previous year on education or health care or transportation. That was often the measurement. And to the extent now it's changing, perhaps, I'm fine with that. But what we need to focus on is how we do better with less, more with less. And to the extent we can do that using technology and using our innovation and our smartness and not knee-jerk attack any possible adjustment in spending in a program that has a good name attached to it, but rather look at, are the results better, perhaps, using less money? So that's my slant on things, and I'm not quite sure where that fits into the political context, but I'm very confident that that's what the public expects from us. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I actually think the concept of doing all you can with the resources available and doing it efficiently is something everyone would subscribe to and does.
Yeah, our whole focus has been on how can we run the government more efficiently and more cost effectively and spend taxpayers wisely, and that's, you've got great leaders in our agencies. I heard from several of them here today, and all of them are watching every dial, every penny of taxpayers' money every day. I'd like to just close on this one point, and that is in his admonishment to the legislature to get real. The legislature's budget chief used the Groundhog Day analogy, and that we keep reliving the same day over and over again every year. And in order to get out of our fiscal predicament, we need to change our ways. It's our sincere desire to have the legislature on both sides of the aisle work with us in a bipartisan way to adopt a common sense budgeting process here in Maryland, where spending does not automatically increase at a rate that continually outpaces revenue, one where we exercise real fiscal discipline and where taxpayer dollars are wisely spent, protected, and respected. And that's my final comment. I guess, is there a motion on this one particular item, or should we do it all together? Or do we make a motion on the? Are there any other questions on any other parts of the DBM agenda?
I did have one question, Governor.
Okay.
Item three.
Item what?
Item three. It's just the confusion on my part, quite candidly. It's the Department of Health.
Athos Allen. Alexandro is the director of the Medicaid Pharmacy Program.
So, good morning.
Athos Alexandro, director of the Medicaid Pharmacy Program.
Yes.
Good morning.
I'm looking at what is page 39 on what we have of your remarks. And it notes that the department's responsible for complying with the guidelines from the national application of the AAC-based pharmacy reimbursement, which was championed by the National Association of State Medicaid Directors. Among the recommendations was establishment of a single national price benchmark for pharmacy reimbursement based on average cost of drug acquisition. Such benchmark provides the agencies with more accurate, responsive pricing methodology. Okay. I see your procurement. The question is, with this system, which I think, but I'm not 100% sure I understand, how do we know that we're getting the best price and couldn't get it cheaper just because we're comparing to average?
Great question, Madam Treasurer. Let me just give you a one-minute background information, if you will.
Because it is several million.
Sure. Currently, the way Medicaid pharmacy works, we reimburse pharmacies for the drugs that Medicaid patients get under the Medicaid pharmacy program. And we are currently estimating the pharmacy's acquisition cost. And, in fact, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services issued a ruling earlier this year where they require all 50 states to stop using estimated acquisition costs and actually start using what is known as the actual acquisition cost. And CMS has been publishing the actual acquisition cost. So what we are changing is not the way we purchase drugs. It's the way we will be reimbursing pharmacies.
And that reimbursement mechanism, Dana Dembro, Director of Procurement with the Department of Health and Mental Hygiene, excuse me for approaching late, that mechanism is going to be based on actual drug acquisition costs instead of estimated drug acquisition costs. I also want to point out that the recommended awardee is the national leader in this area. They are the ones who do the average acquisition cost study for the Centers of Medicare and Medicaid that has been done before. This actual acquisition cost was placed into effect, required as of April the 1st of the coming year. They've been doing this for 39 years in 20 different states. This is the major innovator in hopefully
but
reducing costs.
They actually were the second in terms of
they were the recommended awardee is far and away above rated, technically higher
right.
in every element of the evaluation.
Okay.
The financial was slightly higher than the competitor, namely $77,000 over a seven-year period, including the option year, which is $11,000 a year. The justification of the higher prices is easy to make.
Okay. So you're saying this use of this new benchmark system will allow us to gauge not only that we are reimbursing at the average, but that we're getting the best deal we can.
That's correct, and it is required by Medicaid in order to accomplish that goal.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. I just want to thank Delegate Dembro because there's somebody who is very, very smart and gives a lot of good oversight. So
thank you very much. We are pinching pennies, and we will continue to do so. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Not only that, but I really like the remark about
the administration.
Thank you.
Approaching the plate.
Stepping
up to the plate.
I'm sorry I was a little late. I saw a high school friend who arrived, and I was filling him in on the admirable discussion and correct decision that was just made with respect to the $82 million required budget cut. So he's up to date in future articles. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions on the EDM agenda? Motion.
Second.
3-0 on the EDM. And I guess now we'll move on to the Secretary's agenda. Secretary McDonald.
Good morning, Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. We have 12 items on the Secretary's agenda. We have 4 reports of emergency procurement. We're ready for any of your questions on any items, and we do have requests to speak on one of our items.
Yeah, it looks like we have people signed up to speak on item 10.
Right, so Ms. Lynn Buell, if you want to take that
before
out?
We get to them, let's hear from the representative from the Maryland Department of Environment.
Ms. Lynn Buell is here from the Department of Environment, Assistant Secretary. She's going to stand up and explain the project in item 10.
Good morning. I'm Lynn Buell, Director of the Water Management Administration at the Maryland Department of Environment. Thank you for the opportunity to speak on behalf of this project. There are a number of representatives from Queen Anne's County who are also here who are certainly able to provide a lot of the detail on all of the local initiative that was involved in putting this project together. We're here to request your approval of the Phase 1 of their Southern Kent Island Sanitary Project, which will connect properties currently served by septic systems on Southern Kent Island to the Kent Island Wastewater Treatment Plant, which has been upgraded to enhance nitrogen removal. So, state of the art. I do want to emphasize that the decision to do this, to put this project together, was initiated at the local level. We are here to recommend that the board approve the funding that MDA is able to supply to these types of projects. I think from a technical standpoint, the areas to be served are characterized by high water tables, soils with poor permeability, and small lot sizes. And those three features combined are not optimal for septic system usage. Currently, 80% of the septic systems in the areas to be served are discharging wastewater containing pathogens and nutrients directly to groundwater, which can seep up to the surface. There are plenty of photographs of individual residential lawns where there's sort of a sheen. They leach into drinking water wells and they migrate or migrate into the bay. So we see this as a project that addresses both public health concerns and nutrient loading into the Chesapeake Bay. The project will connect 1,518 existing homes and 8 commercial properties located in the southern part of Kent Island. Phase one, which is this, just the only part we're asking you to approve today, will serve 784 properties. This first phase also will cover the construction of the transmission main from that part of the island up to the plant. And then, of course, there are 3 additional phases over the next 10 years. There's been a lot of question about whether this might foster unwanted development in that part of the state. The county has thoroughly examined this. There are a number of vacant lots that will be part of the area to be served. The county and with our help have worked to really limit what type of infill development might be feasible and not have this cause some type of runaway, unthought through, unplanned development. The county estimates that actual infill development will be about 560 properties as opposed to 1,600 potential. I think they may be in a better position to explain exactly how they looked at that and what they have put into place to limit that. And any new lot development will be subject to an economic benefit premium fee paid to the county so that they, because since they will benefit, some of those lots can't be built on now due to the septic challenges, that it is not an unjust enrichment. I think I might stop there. If I may, I'm happy to try and answer some questions, although I think if the county would like to have an opportunity to present all that went into this, this discussion with them has gone on for, oh boy, I would say at least 5 years and perhaps longer. And so they're to be commended for their continuing effort to try and work through a very feasible and thoughtful solution.
Thank you, Madam Director. I would say just hang out and we can have questions, but let's let the other speakers go.
Can I ask the Secretary just one question? One of the provisions, as I recall, was that Queen Anne's County was to do an assessment of climate change impact and what that means in terms of the rising water and enhancing the resilience and stuff, and to be doing it with the Department of Natural Resources. Do you know?
I'm not certain if the Department of Natural Resources. Yes, you're right. I think the Smart Growth subcabinet requested that study be done, and I don't know exactly who performed it. I do know that they took a look at it in terms of the impact of climate on the floodplain, where you draw the lines. I think from our end, the conclusion they drew is this new. Obviously, that renders septic systems even more unsuitable, and so that what they've designed here, and believe me, I'm not an engineer, so is a sealed pressure system, though, that would be the best technique to use to withstand what might be additional pressures.
I would be interested, I don't know who is to address this, but at some point, whether it's the department or the county or whatever. What you all have done. Thank you.
Yes, certainly.
Because most of my questions are to do with what the state is involved in here. So I understand there are $33 million in loans primarily, but also some grants. How does that break down?
If I may, I'd like to invite Jag Kuhman, who is our Water Quality Finance Administration Manager, to go through some of the details of the financing.
Sure, but stick around.
Good morning. My name is Jag Kuhman, also with the Department of the Environment. Mr. Comptroller, essentially this phase one is $33 million in low-interest rate loans. However, the Bay Restoration Fund will also be providing grants to the counties annually, from which the county will actually benefit about $15 million in grants over the next 30 to 40 years.
Okay, and what is the interest rate on the loans?
The interest rate changes monthly. At this point, it is 0.6%.
I'm sorry, that was what?
0.6%.
So less than 1%.
It is less than 1%.
So I obviously have no problem, Madam. Is it Secretary or
Director?
Director. Okay, great. I have no problem with MDE advocating that we update septic systems and even replace them with, sewer lines, et cetera, around the state where it's appropriate. I do have some problems with this proposal. First of all, I guess, because we're financing it, the taxpayers are, at a very lucrative rate, 0.6. That was below market, I think. Here's the problem that I have. I have no problem with the sewer line, necessarily. It's the opening up of hundreds and hundreds of vacant lots, and my concern that you're, despite the best intentions and promises of the local authorities, how are they going to withstand legal challenges to, instead of hundreds, have thousands of lots opened up to what anybody would describe as, I don't want to stigmatize it by saying it's sprawl development, but it is development in an area where the land is sinking and the bay is rising. So it's kind of questionable as to whether through our well-intentioned funding of this, we end up opening an area up to not just hundreds, but more than hundreds, I guess over 1,000. Okay, so I have been concerned about this for many years. I love Queen Anne's County, but I have a particular concern about the adverse effects of this kind of development in an area that strikes me as inappropriate because of the flooding. But, so is there someone here that could talk about the total environmental impacts, not just of the sewer line, but of the development of these new properties? Apparently, the, you quoted there were 618 or something?
632 is the maximum permitted under the Smart Growth Coordinating Committee's exception that was approved for the priority funding area.
So what prevents that from being expanded to the full 1,600?
The agreement with the county is for 50 years. If that, if they violate that agreement, they have to pay us back the $15 million of grants that the project will be providing.
Okay. How about the road infrastructure? We looked at that as far as the hundreds of new lots, even with the cap. And the thousands of cars, how would that impact traffic on Ken Island?
We did not look into the details of the roads.
That's okay. And I take it the public school system, they have indicated the impact or not indicated the impact?
I guess that's not really environment questions.
I'll to address those.
We want to have the opponents speak, then we want to have the county speak, and then we can ask.
We'll get to that. I do have one question while you're here, though, since you did mention this, that this is the Maryland Department of the Environment. Apparently, this project was listed as 101st out of a total of 110 projects on a priority list last June, less than 5 months ago. So how did it get moved up the priority list so quickly, where 100 projects were listed ahead of this one?
Mr. Comptroller, I think the opponents who said that did not have all the facts. The project, actually, the county has been applying for these three phases. The first phase, which has three contracts, they've been applying every year. So the project was on our funding list for the past 2 years. They recently applied again for the third contract. We've consolidated all of those projects into one big loan. Now, with the revolving loan fund, even though you may be not a very high priority ranking on a priority list, the fund has plenty of revolving loan funds to address any ready-to-proceed project that's environmentally viable. And therefore, we have not denied anybody revolving loan funding as long as it's a ready-to-proceed project and we believe it'll do environmental good.
Okay. Just finally, for the Department of the Environment, in approving this and recommending that we improve it, you don't see us as creating a bigger problem for the environment down the road. Is that?
I would say no, because we are really removing lots of pounds of nutrients and protecting public health. So I would say net, it will be a benefit.
Okay. Sorry, Governor.
No problem.
I took advantage of them being here.
That's okay. They're going to stick around just in case we have more questions for them after all the rest. But let's move on to some of the speakers here. First on the list, we have Jay Falstad from the Queen Anne's Conservation Association, Executive Director.
Morning. I'll just get my papers in order 1 second. Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller, thank you very much for the privilege to speak before you today. I'm the Executive Director of Queen Anne's Conservation, celebrating our 46th year as the Eastern Shore's oldest land use conservation and environmental organization. I'd like to start off by recognizing that we do believe that there are failing septic tanks on southern Kent Island. I don't think that that can be disputed. There are neighborhoods, particularly in Roman Coke and Kent Island Estates, where they have an obvious problem. And I've been down there. I've smelled the smells. And I acknowledge that there's a problem. But it is nowhere near the level that justifies the expense of $33 million of taxpayer money. QACA, Queen Anne's Conservation Association, has concerns with not only the financing of this project, but also its ecological impact. The proposed development areas of vacant lots include ecologically sensitive areas, woodlands, wetlands, all containing wildlife, and we believe that the county is attempting to fix one problem, but creating a much greater one, certainly to the environment and probably to the taxpayer. We believe that the sewer line, as it's proposed right now, will open up a Pandora's box and create a money pit that will require the county to come before this board at future dates, requesting funds for flooding controls, school expansions, roadway improvements, etc. Really, the heart of the matter is, in our view, that the state should not be encouraging residential and commercial development on a vulnerable island that's prone to flooding and storm surge. Over the years, we have met with officials at MDE under the prior administration. We have filed multiple Public Information Act requests aimed at trying to understand this very complicated problem. We have retained wastewater engineers from the on-site Wastewater Recycling Association and the American Society of Sanitary Engineers. And based on all of that, here is what we found. While there are certainly problems in some of the neighborhoods on southern Kent Island, the septic failures that we have found are sporadic, and the failures do not affect every single home in every neighborhood, and certainly nowhere near the 1,700 homes that would be in the proposed service area. The county is attempting to run a costly sewer line when it may not need it. While there are reports of foul waters during certain times of the year, particularly during flooding times, and it's not a widespread problem, but it is isolated. Based on our Public Information Act request, there are no documented cases of public health that can be attributed to the gray water from failing septics. And even the Midshore Riverkeeper Conservancy, an organization that has testified in favor of sewer lines, on its report card shows that the area of Eastern Bay off southern Kent Island receives some of its highest water quality marks. Treasurer Kopp, you raised something in the very beginning of your statement that I just want to touch upon. Kent Island, like other areas in the Tidewater region of the Bay, is beginning to see impacts of sea level rise. Just recently, the county did a sea level rise and coastal vulnerability assessment. And it very clearly in this document shows that the island is subject to flooding, and it is a problem. During Hurricane Isabel a few years ago, southern Kent Island was divided into three smaller islands, with one roadway where people couldn't get through for 2 days. Since the time of John Smith, a number of islands have gone under the waves, and Kent Island is not a geographical oddity that's going to somehow beat that. So, as the comptroller noted, this project is ranked pretty low on the list. But in evaluating it, one of the things that I was troubled by is on this list, the closest comparables that I could find were number 21, number 46, and 109. And they each of those have an average cost of $37.6 million. But what's interesting to note is on the far right or left-hand column, it'll show what the benefiting population is for that expense. The average benefiting population on all those is 359,000 people, or I guess that's what it is. On this one, the Kent Island sewer line shows a benefiting population of 500. So we have some real concerns about why there's such an imbalance on the amount of money that is being spent on this. Lastly, the loan terms on this, as you mentioned, Mr. Comptroller, are 0.6%. And I've talked to MDE about the criteria used for such a rate. I think I understand why it's being applied here. I'm not sure I agree with the numbers. But regardless, when you look at a bunch of waterfront homes on southern Kent Island, there's some 200 right now that are for sale on all of Kent Island. The average home price is $350,000. The highest priced home that I could find is $2.9 million. It is really difficult with a straight face to say that somehow Kent Island should be receiving the disadvantaged community rate. So if you were to approve the financing of this project today, you are tacitly committing to, or are you tacitly committing to the financing of the remaining three phases, which are not part of today's discussion? Has the Board of Public Works reviewed the cash flow projections of Phase 1? And have you asked the questions on if you're satisfied if the Phase 1 debt can be serviced if the additional financing required to build the remaining phases is not approved? So, in closing, with all of the other engineers that we talked with, we do believe that there are alternative solutions that are less costly that should be explored. We're happy to work with MDE and share some of the things that we found. We do not believe that the state should be encouraging commercial and residential development on southern Kent Island. And we simply ask that the Maryland Department of Environment reevaluate the cost of this project relative to other projects around the state. We just want to make sure that taxpayers are getting the most for their money. These documents raise some questions. And with that, thank you for the opportunity. I'll be happy to answer any questions if you have any. Otherwise, I'll sit down and
thank you, Jay.
Thank you.
Any questions?
No, very good presentation.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate you being here this morning.
Thank you.
Next, we have the Kent Island Defense Fund, Barbara Obert.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak today. I served on the Queen Anne County Public Works Advisory Board, which studied this project intensively. Culminating years of work, the Public Works Advisory Board actually voted to recommend a public sewerage plan of lower cost pocket plants targeted directly in the areas intended to be removed from septic systems. In a matter of days and weeks after that recommendation, the county took action to pressure the vote by the Public Works Advisory Board to be voided and replaced with a recommendation for full sewer, large capacity pipe, funding source unknown, and it promptly disbanded the Public Works Advisory Board. in the 5 years since that time as complex sewer plans developed, I have consistently pressed for fiscal governance and answers to some of the remaining financial questions that need to be answered for tens of millions of dollars in state funding to be directed for such a large infrastructure project in a flood-prone, non-PFA area at the risk of sea level rise. Governor, I thank you for pointing out the heroics that occurred in Ellicott City. It's a reminder of the perils and costs which will occur in this area that, according to the state report, will be subjected to issues related to sea level rise. I'd like to highlight three quick issues with the financing plan. First of all, there is not a viable financial plan to pay back the state debt and investment. I personally filed MPIA requests asking about the cash flow for the existing sanitary district after former commissioners expressed concerns that the existing debt couldn't be paid off and the maintenance fund for an aging plant wasn't maintained. There was no response. But during that time, the county hired a well-known, well-connected lobbyist to secure agreement for more state money to forgive that old debt while creating new debt. Additionally, the revenue estimates on this require us to develop new lots, putting an increasing number of residences, people, and infrastructure in harm's way, where we are regularly cut off by flooding during major storms. And by the way, that debt will not be paid off before a significant portion of the existing homes and newly developed properties that are currently considered to be wetlands are covered in the sea level rise as indicated in the state-mandated study. The revenue estimates also require citizens to sign away rights of way to their private property that currently don't exist. There are no defined penalties on circumventing restrictions. For example, there is an exemption for the commercial properties that you mentioned. So with a suburban commercial, head-on suburban commercial designation which allows commercial and residential combined development, ostensibly, the 632 individual family residences ostensibly could be replicated by 600 more multi-family apartments, condos, or other dwellings. There's no knowing how much of that will be developed out. And the county does have a history of breaking denied access. Finally, there are significant unknowns cost for this added infrastructure in terms of additional schools, roads, and in this flood-prone area, the repairs to that infrastructure. And those are not included even in the $33 million today. So I respectfully request that you postpone approval of the $33 million until 75% of those right-of-way easements that I mentioned are obtained for the full trunk line and the neighborhood hookups, to promise the guaranteed revenue to pay back the state debts and your grant investment, that you postpone it for an independent third-party audit of the cash flow, because there's no proof or even an indicator that even with all the easements signed, that the county can build and maintain this line, especially given that we've had to get more state money for old debt in order to move forward with new debt. And finally, please postpone until there are defined legally enforceable penalties in place for those other properties that can circumvent the smart growth requirement limits. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have James Brown, the resident of Kent Island State. Mr. Brown, not here?
No.
Well, then we'll move on to we have maybe all three of these want to come up together or separately, but we have Queen Anne's County Commissioner Jim Moran, Queen Anne County Administrator Greg Todd, and Queen Anne County Public Works Director Todd Moe.
Good morning. Thank you for the opportunity to be here. My name is Jim Moran. I'm the Queen Anne's County Commissioner at Large. With me is County Administrator Greg Todd.
Good morning.
Department of Public Works Director Todd Moe. And I don't know if if you want us to start, or if you want to just start asking us questions.
I think you ought to go ahead and kind of give us your presentation of why the county feels we need to move forward with the sewer.
Thank you. Good morning, Governor Hogan, Treasurer Kopp, and Comptroller Franco. As Jim said, I'm County Administrator Greg Todd, and I want to thank you guys for taking the opportunity to hear our testimony. It is important to us. And as you've heard, the opposition, that it costs too much money, which the argument is that it's taxpayer dollars. Well, it's also taxpayers that are paying it back. It's homeowners are paying it back. There's no documented health problem. We've heard that. And that it's a developer-friendly project. It's sprawl. It's all these lots are going to be developed. There's no block to it. So I want to go through kind of how we got here, if you don't mind, if I can just take a minute or two and give you a little background. We started looking at this in earnest about 2012, 2013. And there were three major hurdles that we had to overcome before we could really move forward. The first was, as you've heard, the 1,600 vacant lots. And no one wanted to develop out 1,600 vacant lots. And Todd, I don't know if you have that plan, but we can see that plan. There was no documented help. The communities were outside the priority funding area and therefore unable to access Bay Restoration Funds or the State Revolving Loan Grant for the public sewer. And the cost of the traditional vacuum sewer project was just too expensive. And as you know, Kent Island, it's flat. It's as flat as this board. And with sewer, you either need to pull it or you need to push it on Kent Island because there's no gravity. It doesn't go anywhere. So those were what we faced. And we also had, you know, in 2007, we got the State Revolving Loan Fund to upgrade our plant to ENR and to upgrade the capacity of it to another million gallons. And that was an $18 million loan, which I want to comment that we're paid up on. We're not delinquent on any of those payments. So we started looking at this with MDE, and the first thing that I want to address was the 1,600 vacant lots. And we used two mechanisms to get this down. The first one was the 2005 Maryland Attorney General's opinion regarding sewer systems and the necessity to serve. And I just want to read a quote out of his opinion, was that the county is not necessarily obligated to provide service to a street with vacant lots. If there is no current need for a sewer line along a street, and it would be feasible to design a system without laying a line along the street could be excluded from the defined service area. So that was tool number one. We used that to knock off the Southern Kent Island. There's nine communities, 1,600 vacant lots. A lot of them were in big chunks with paper roads that were never going to get developed if we didn't have to. So we were able to eliminate quite a few of them with that. And the next step we used was a grandfather merger ordinance, County Ordinance 1324, that requires adjacent parcels under the same ownership to merge to fit the underlying zoning. So as an example, as you'll see, a lot of these lots down on Kent Island, this is Kent Island Estates, by the way, are very small. They're houses set on 5,000 square foot lots. Well, if the underlying zoning is 15,000 square feet, and if you own three lots, we're making you combine them. So you've got to match that underlying zoning. So even though your house might be on one and you've got two next to it, that gets combined. So automatically those go away. Now, the other question was how do we, you know, we've heard that the county goes back on their promises, and how do we guarantee this? Well, this merger ordinance has already been taken to court, and it ended up in the 4th U.S. District Court, and it was thrown out. It was thrown out because it didn't, the process we went through, you know, it's not a takings because there's still value left in your lot. It's not due, you know, there's a due process, but it didn't live up to that standard. So we feel very confident that we've addressed all those issues. Plus, the plant's only 3 million gallons. With this 500,000 gallons that was reserved for the 1,500 homes and 600 vacant lots and other projects on Kent Island, we're at capacity. We would have to come back to MDE to upgrade the plant to do more development. So there's no way that the county ourselves could ever do it. I want to talk about the priority funding.
Can I just stop a second on that? Because that's one of the things that did concern me. A county government decides one thing. There's an election that decides another thing. But you're saying that the physical capacity of this plant wouldn't allow it to go beyond what is now.
Yeah, we with the projects we have on the books, Four Seasons being one of them, which I know you guys are familiar with, and some of the others in Kent Island area, we've got 60,000, 70,000 gallons of capacity left once everything's built out. So we don't have the capacity to ever expand. We would have to come back to the state. We could get an upgrade on the plant, but that requires MDE approval. So it would be a state decision at the end of the day whether we ever expand or not. So that's really, I mean, that's for the fail-safes to prevent that between the ordinance, you know, and the capacity, we are really restricted.
And we'd have to pay back the $15 million right. in big restoration.
Yeah, I get that. But that's a political decision. That's not hardware stopping you.
So
you're saying that the hard...
The hard one is the capacity, absolutely. So then we looked at going back, the other issue was priority funding area. These subdivisions were outside of the priority funding area, outside of the growth area. So how do we access the Bay Restoration Funds, which was, as JAG says, a big part of this. Well, we went to the legislature in 2014 and got House Bill 11 passed, which House Bill 11 authorized the use of Bay Restoration Funds for public sewer to relieve failing septic systems outside of a priority funding area based on four considerations. A public health risk, which was confirmed in 1995 through a sanitary survey that confirmed 80% of the ski septic systems discharged directly into groundwater, and the 2007 Queen Anne's County Health Officer report that concluded there was clear evidence of continuing septic system failures. Potential infill development was the other thing that we had to address, which we just talked about how we got to that. Growth impact mitigation measures. So when we look at it and we think, well, there's 1,600 vacant lots that could be built, that's going to be a huge impact on all of our infrastructure right off the bat. Well, if they all built within 2 or 3 years, yes. But you have to understand, if you look at these maps, these vacant lots are all interdispersed amongst all the other homes. And of the 632 vacant lots we have, I think 80% of them are owned by single owner, so there's not like a big developer down there looking to build. And looking at our market, our residential market, and talking to realtors, the saturation rate is low. It's 10 or 15 homes a year on Kent Island. So it would be very difficult to build all this at once. We've got Cloverfields and Bay City are two other sewer projects we did on Kent Island. It's taken 20 years to build out the vacant lots in there. It's a land issue. Excuse me. And then the last issue that House Bill 11 had us look at was nitrogen reduction. I think Jake touched on it. There'll be 17,300 pounds of annual reduction of nitrogen just by hooking up these failing septics and also even with the new growth added in. So it's a net, it's a huge net reduction. It meets our county WIP goal, 33% of our county WIP goal, excuse me. And if we didn't do this, the county would have to have best available technology on 90% of our septic tanks in the county to ever meet our WIP goal. So all of these considerations we had to look at. We went to the Smart Growth Coordinating Committee, it was mentioned earlier, and they put more restrictions on us. And we were all a little scared going to the Smart Growth Coordinating Committee. But they actually applauded this project at the end. I mean, they clapped. It was such a good project for them. So we got through all those hurdles, and that left us with the cost. And sorry, my mouth's getting dry. I realize the cost is a big issue, but as we talked about, it's paid for by the users. So the taxpayers, at the end of the day, aren't being impacted from it. So we feel, all things considered, it's a good project. We would like to support you moving forward. And you know, it's not a big developer brouhaha. It's going to be built out slowly over a number of years, and it's going to help the 1,518 homeowners down there that are really struggling. So I thank you for your time. Take any questions?
Anybody else want to speak before we?
I would just like to say, from the standpoint of who this really impacts, are the homeowners on Southern Kent Island. This has been a problem for 30 or 40 years in Queen Anne's County, and it has finally come to light over the last 5 years with what the county administrator just said, with these different hurdles we had to jump. I will say that, the tax money being spent on this all gets paid back. This project is, for Maryland Department of the Environment, I think it is a model program. I sat on the Healthy Waters Roundtable for the Maryland's Eastern Shore. And everybody there, other counties come up and say, how are you doing this? How are you taking care of your failing septic systems with dedicated lines? And, you know, I want to commend NDE and everybody involved on this, because this is a project that will help. I heard statements about schools Our school populations are about down for the last 3 years. The 1,500 and 18 homes in southern Kent Island, property values are depressed almost 30%. So, I mean, you know, there's homeowners down there that are going to have to go on holding tanks. There's homeowners down there that can't afford the pump outs that they're having to do monthly. This is the best that we can possibly offer them, $100 a month to pay this project off. It's less than your phone bill. I mean, it's never going to get any better than what it is now. And I agree with the county administrator. The build-out is going to be a slow process over 20 years. I mean, it's going to take us 7 years just to complete the project. And, you know, I heard discussion about the roads. These are already roads in existing communities. We don't have to build roads. A lot of this is directional bore, and it is a sealed system so that, you know, if there is flooding, it doesn't get infiltrated into this sealed system.
Explain what that means. That was mentioned in terms of...
Sealed system?
In the context of rising waters.
Yes, ma'am. So what a sealed system is, right now in Queen Anne's County, because it's so flat, we have a vacuum system so that we're actually pulling the waste towards the wastewater treatment plant, which has open valves, meaning that if water rises and it gets in an open valve, we're actually pulling rainwater to our sewage treatment plant. So with a closed system, we're actually pumping it. Each individual step system has a high head pump inside of it that will take the solids will stay there. We'll collect the solids. Just the effluent gets pumped all the way up to our treatment plant. So it's all sealed, and there's nowhere for air or fluids to get into the system except coming through your home.
Did you look at other? I mean, so the idea was sort of thrown.
Absolutely, absolutely. We've looked at everything, and if we had alternates, they'd be in right now, and we would have even more infill lots. And that's, you know, the one thing that people don't say, there's other solutions. Well, if there's other solutions, they would have been available to those vacant lot owners a long time ago, and there just is not. I mean, this is, you know, we've discussed this. We've gone over every possible avenue that we could, and we've gotten the blessing from many, many organizations.
This question was raised of an audit of the cash flow to make sure. I assume you're... office did projections, but
absolutely.
How do you go through assuring yourselves that those projections are valid?
Well, we went through them two or three times, and then we handed them over to JAG, and JAG went through them, and he said that they were. So, I mean, you know, I don't know who else we could possibly go to. I mean, you know, Director Mond's been with Public Works for 30 years, and this is what they do. They built the sewage collection for the northern part of the county, so it's, you know, I think that they have the experience to speak to that. And JAG, you looked at the numbers. And
Madam Treasurer, if you look at the debt service on this loan, the first phase,
right,
it's about $1.3 million a year on a level debt service. The homeowners, the first group, which is about 750 homes, are going to be providing about $1,000 a year towards the debt service annually. So that covers about half or $750,000 of the debt service. The Bay Restoration Fund, which is putting in $15 million over the time, can cover a small portion of the remaining debt. Plus, the new development, the 600 homes, each one has a benefit surcharge, and that collectively is about $25,000 a home, and collectively bring in another $15 million worth of revenue.
So is this dependent on the new 650?
No. Most of our debt can be covered with the existing user charges. But yes, the cost of the project benefits from the additional new development benefit assessment, because those monies help offset the capital costs.
Absolutely, yes.
And those monies are dedicated to this. They can't
absolutely
just go into,
yes,
a general fund,
yes,
of the county.
Mm-hmm. So we heard from each of the opponents earlier that were, each one of them, I think, talked about rising tides and flooding.
Mm-hmm.
And global warming,
mm-hmm,
and it seems to me, you said 80% of the 1,500 homes,
mm-hmm,
are pouring,
going right into the bay.
You know,
their fluid water is hitting lateral, hitting clay.
It seems like the flooding is an argument why you need to hook them up to sewer.
Well, and again, the last time those roads
situation is horrible.
Yes, sir. And the last time those roads were impassable was Isabel. So, you know, again, and I think we've had roads here. I mean, I know the downtown Annapolis. Get a high tide with the full moon and the wind blowing in the right direction, will flood. So, I mean, yeah, we are concerned about that, but that's no reason to turn our backs on the 1,518 homes down there that are polluting on a daily basis. And the cost of this cost
sewer system is better than failing septic.
Absolutely.
If you have rising water. For sure.
Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. I happen to walk. This is not a new idea. Mm-hmm. Forgive my mentioning, O'Malley Department of Natural Resources had us walking around. The previous governor. In a time past, walked around there. I walked around there. Some of you were with me, maybe. And it was quite clear that there were odoriferous.
Oh, yeah.
Really gross problems that had to have a significant health impact even then. And as I say, I mean, things I think are just getting worse. We're going to have to face this. This is one example. We don't have the authority to go in and tell people they have to leave their homes and tear them down. We don't have that yet. Anyhow, or to tell the people in Ellicott City they can't rebuild unless they, you know, completely redo their infrastructure, or we have to stop putting sands on the beaches of Ocean City.
Right.
I think these questions are coming, not in my time, thank heavens on this board, but until then, it does seem to me, from my experience walking it, seeing it, looking at these numbers, and hearing now from two state administrations in the county, and I am not for more growth any more than anyone else is. I think it makes sense.
Believe me, if we didn't have to do the infill, if the Attorney General didn't tell us to, and we didn't need that to fund this to help existing homeowners, we wouldn't do it. But we just don't have a choice with this to make this work for all parties concerned. And I will say that, over the 5 years, in the beginning there was great opposition. There was great concern from misinformation. And we've done a very good job of informing the public over the last 5 years, and I've been with this, for 3 years, of every step of the process. And we have 85% of the public down there that has allowed us to come onto their property to do the engineering. So, when we voted on this in August?
August
25th. August 25th, three people in the audience against it. So,
yeah,
we heard from citizens down there that complained to us about, I'm going to put this more nicely than they put it to us, but there's like rivers of feces flowing through their front yards.
Correct.
Into the bay.
Right.
And contaminating groundwater.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't sound like the current status quo is really a good way to go.
Thank you.
I was going to say, we did hear from the Mid-Shore River Keepers some time ago.
The River Keepers strongly support this.
Absolutely, yes.
It's a pretty disgusting situation.
Yeah. Yes, sir.
Yeah. Thank you very much for your testimony. Tonight I'm going to be watching the seventh game of the World Series. There's nothing better in life than
absolutely.
That.
It is, absolutely.
Thank God. No MSNBC. I'm going to watch that World Series. Yeah. It would be better if it were the Nats versus the Orioles, that's for sure. But here's the deal. There's a little bit of rain predicted, perhaps. If it rains in Cleveland, what are they going to do? They're going to go and pull a tarp over the infield and wait a little bit. Rain stops, then they're going to go on with the game. They're not going to build a dome over the stadium because there might be a rainfall. This is a very expensive project.
Yes, sir.
We just testified that 80% of the homes down there are pumping sewage directly into the bay or onto the land. Do you have any report or study that documents that? That there are, I don't blame the governor for repeating what someone said, but the idea
the
that
Department of Environment that said that.
Then the Department of Environment, if they could come up, and please explain to me if there are rivers of feces going directly into the bay and onto the surface of, not the groundwater, but the surface water, what kind of documentation do you have of that as far as health effects? Because obviously there are people that are going to be ill from that. There are going to be protections taken by DNR about fishing and recreation and swimming. If there are, Madam Lynn Mrs. Buell, I guess you're the MDE. If, in fact, we have rivers of feces going directly from the homes, 80% of the homes, how do we permit swimming? How do we permit walking? How do we permit crabbing? How do we permit oyster harvesting in rivers of feces?
Well,
please.
To be fair, that wasn't something that came from any of us, rivers of feces. That was an email that the governor received.
None of us are talking about in their front yard.
Correct.
Yeah.
Right, right.
Well, I'm interested in that because my point here is that I think the TARP analogy is accurate. There may be 40 homes that have a problem with their septic systems, and I believe we could not cover that up, but we could bring the TARP on and fix those 40 or 50 homes for a lot less money than we're spending right now on this sewer system, and we would not have this problem of sprawl development, because that obviously looms in the background. I can't imagine the developers not being interested in taking advantage of this new sewer system to build more lots. But the question is, if you have documentation of sewage being in the surface water, not the groundwater, the surface water, and or going directly into the bay, why can't we just fix those homes that have that?
I think the issue is that I don't know where you pulled the 40 or 50, but their report says 80% of the 1,500. That means 1,200. I didn't do the report, but it seems like a big difference between 40 or 50 or 1,200.
Which is it then?
It's 1,200.
Excuse me?
What?
No, tell me, because
I think there's a difference between a failing septic system and rivers of feces running over a yard. A failing septic system means that the effluent is not getting treated. It's going straight from the laterals into the groundwater. And that's the problem we have down there. Now, I do have pictures of backyards full of waste, wastewater. Sheila, if you don't mind. So when we hear talk about alternative systems and there's got to be a way to fix it, I think you heard earlier about the three problems. Lot sizes are too small. The ground is not pervious enough. And the groundwater is too high. So when you've got a lot, say this is your lot, okay? And as an example, the bottom of this is your septic field, and your groundwater is up here. There's no place for that fluid except for the groundwater. And that's what we're running into.
Yeah, but what we're talking about is surface water, not groundwater.
Well, both.
No.
80% is contaminating the ground.
I'm talking about the groundwater.
Yeah, but that's, okay, well, that's exactly the point. If the perhaps the secretary representative could comment on that. The issue of public health as far as groundwater is completely different from surface water, number one. Number two, the drinking water, I take it, is still all going to be taken from wells, so there's no contamination of wells.
No, the wells are deep enough. It's a different aquifer.
Uh-huh.
But when your groundwater is 3 inches, which we have done tested, 3 inches from the top of the ground, it's going to be in those ditches, and that's what we're running into. It seeps over into the ditches, so the ditches have effluent in them. You can smell it down there. It's not.
I'm not denying you can't. It's not odoriferous, as the treasurer said. I'm sure it is. My only problem is misinformation about how serious the problem is, and to the extent you're saying 80% have failing systems because some of the groundwater is having some exposure. That's completely different from what the citizens are talking about with these pictures. This is surface water. And to confuse the two and imply that 80% are failing because they don't have the 3 feet of sand between the leaching field and the surface or the top of the groundwater, I think it's a very, you end up, instead of taking the tarp out and covering it and doing it in a relatively inexpensive way, you end up putting something in which is unnecessary for most of the 1,500 septic systems down there. Most of them operate just fine. They don't have that
problem. So you know, the tarp is a holding tank, okay? and a holding tank during the high groundwater level, they're pumping out once or twice a week for $600 a month, a pump out. That's your tarp. Your tarp is incredibly expensive to the homeowners because all that water, we've seen it. We have seen them open up a tank and pump it out and never stop pumping because that groundwater is being pulled back through the laterals. And when that groundwater is a couple inches from the surface, it is surface water in some areas. Okay?
Yeah, but you're confusing the board here with your statement that 80% of the systems are failing. You have a small number of systems that are failing and causing the kind of uproar that I would like to correct also. But in correcting that small number, you're misinforming us about the fact that there are 80% of these are failing, and secondarily, that we need to spend $33 million helping you build a sewage system that will open it up to just, well, how can you call it anything other than sprawl development?
Well,
let me just jump in here for a second. I mean, how would you say that? They're misrepresenting. 80% of the septic systems are failing, and that's what all the tests have shown. That's what the Department of Environment says. How could you say they're not?
Yeah.
I mean,
they're not.
Maybe 40 or 50 have rivers of feces, yes. But 80% of them are leaching into the groundwater.
The definition for the septic system that are on those existing homes, under their definition, 80% of them are failing. That
okay.
is correct.
Do you have that study? Is that your study?
No.
Whose study is it?
Health department.
Who? The health department.
Yeah, the health
Where
department.
Are that? What's that? The county?
County.
Where are they?
The health department is a state.
They here?
They're not here with us today, no.
Where's the study? Because it doesn't exist.
That is not true.
I disagree with that. Yes, sir.
We will get you
that. The 80% of those systems
are failing.
Yeah. But it's a definitional issue, right? In other words, what they're saying is that there is not 2 inches. There's not 3 feet of sand between the leach field and the surface water.
They're saying that the effluent is draining directly into the groundwater. That's the definition of failure.
Okay, if you find me a study that says 80% of the failing septic systems are putting bacteria into the surface water and directly into the bay, I'll go back and change my vote. But if what you're talking about is groundwater, which is a very technical definition and does not, for example, if we had all of this, are there any documented cases of a single health issue over the last 10 years?
Well, we prefer to be proactive versus reactive.
Really?
Yes.
So with all of this feces all over the place, in the groundwater and on the surface water. Not a single case
reported
of illness.
Reported, correct.
Any instance of anybody saying they shouldn't swim or fish or crab in the waters? Any one single instance. So, unfortunately, we are being misinformed here, and I appreciate all of your testimony, but I really resent the tens of millions of dollars that we're spending unnecessarily to take care of this issue.
Appreciate your comments, Comptroller.
Any other questions or comments from either you or from the Treasurer?
No, except I disagree with
You know, 80% of the existing septic systems on South Ken Island are failing. It is an environmental problem that is threatening the health of the Chesapeake Bay and the health of our citizens. It's a problem that has been plaguing this area for far too long, and the status quo is polluting the Chesapeake Bay and allowing wastewater to leach into the groundwater, which poses a serious public health concern, according to the health department, for the residents there. The residents are contacting us complaining about the smells, about the problems in the water, the issues they have to deal with the pump outs and all the Band-Aid approaches. Addressing these problems by extending the sewer service represents, in my opinion, the best solution for reducing nitrogen pollution in the bay, and for alleviating the public health risk to the community of having sewage floating around in their groundwater or laying in the yard. I understand that there are people here that feel very strongly and they're very passionate. They fear the prospect of additional development. You've stated very clearly that you've committed that the system can't handle more than those 600 potential lots, which you're saying you know won't even be a real factor on the 600, and that you'd have to pay all the money back. You'd be penalized. So I don't know where all the concern comes from. I'm concerned about the 1,500 people that live there now being living in these conditions. So I think that, you know, the facts, the Queen Anne County provided some facts. The Maryland Department of Environment did studies that clearly show that connecting the sewer service will enhance the nutrient removal process and will result in a 75% decrease in nitrogen discharge into the bay rather than installing best available technology septic systems. And even if there were to be some additional development, MDE decided that connecting South Kent Island to the existing wastewater treatment plant would still result in a significant net positive benefit in water quality to the bay, something that the Midshore Riverkeepers acknowledged in their letter strongly supporting this project. So it sounds like there's somewhat of a disagreement on the board on this one particular issue. So I think we'll separate out a vote on item 10. I'd like to make a motion to approve item 10. Is there a second?
Second.
I assume the comptroller is going to be a no.
Yes.
We'll vote 2-0. The motion passes.
2-1.
I'm sorry.
I didn't mean to forget you.
The romance is not over. Look, I don't even agree with my wife 100% of the time.
Let's assure this is a temporary situation. But could I just add, on top of what the governor said, this is a discussion that's been going on since the 1990s, and the problem is has gotten worse and worse over the time, and will get worse as the sea level rises and the ground level subsides and gets sodden. Now, I don't know how long you're in this for 50 years now. What mm-hmm. it's going to be like in 50 years. We know, I suppose, that between now and 50 years from now, it'll be better because of this correction.
Madam Treasurer, I'm sure their able counsel, Mr. Bariano, will figure that out 50 years from now. But it is a valid.
Mr. Bariano, how are you this morning? I just think there's no really happy choice, but this is a healthier choice.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. So the motion on that one, that carries, item 10 carries 2-1. Are there any other questions on the balance of the
second?
3-0 on the balance.
Thank you.
Now we're going to move on to the DNR real property agenda.
Good morning, Governor. Good morning, Comptroller, Madam Treasurer. For the record, I'm Mark Belton, Secretary of the Maryland Department of Natural Resources. We have 8 items on our real property agenda for your approval this morning.
Thank you, Secretary Belton. Any questions on DNR? Is there a motion?
Move approval.
Second, 3-0. Now, move on to the university system agenda.
Good morning. Joe Evans, representing the University System of Maryland. We have 2 items on the agenda today. Here to answer any questions.
Good morning, Joe. Any questions on University of Maryland?
Governor, not a question, but an opportunity. I want to thank the Lieutenant Governor. You were taken away unexpectedly to a funeral, and the Lieutenant Governor stepped in for a wonderful groundbreaking at the University of Shady Groves.
Very excited.
And it just, I hope you were there, Joe. If you haven't, go visit it. It's just a really very exciting.
Thank you for pointing it out. We're really proud. Everybody worked together on it. It's a great. I really hated missing that. That was an important funeral, but we're very excited to see that up. Thank you. Motion on the university system. Second. 3-0.
Thank you.
We'll move on to information technology. We're just blowing through them now.
Good morning, Governor, Mr. Comptroller, and Madam Treasurer. For the record, I'm Luis Estrada, Deputy Secretary of the Department of Information Technology. Today we have two items on the agenda. We're withdrawing item 2IT, and we have representatives to answer questions on the remaining items.
Yeah, I've got some concern about item 1. Do we have a representative from Baltimore City Community College?
Dan Coleman, Procurement Director.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, Governor. Good morning, Madam Treasurer. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Coleman.
Mr. Controller. My name is Daniel Coleman. I'm the Director of Procurement at Baltimore City Community College. Here to answer your questions.
Well, good morning. Thank you for being here. This item that you bring before us today is a request to approve something that we really hate to see here for two reasons. One, it's retroactive, and two, it's a sole source contract for software services for the library catalog system, right? And it seems that the last four contracts that you brought to the Board of Public Works dating back to 2014 were all sole source contracts, and two of those were retroactive. So it's a thing that we talk about here almost every week.
Yes.
One time is sort of an oops, and you know, we usually let it slide, you know, but the second, third, fourth, and now fifth time starts to seem like a pattern and, you know, somewhat disturbing pattern to us. The material that you provided us here states that the staff turnover was the cause of this most recent retroactive sole source contract. But to me, it actually looks like the old staff may have actually been the problem because it kept happening over and over again. And I know that you've taken some remedial actions to fix this problem.
That's true.
But we've been told that no payments have been made to the vendor for over 2 years, and I don't understand that. I mean, it seems completely unacceptable. And companies that are doing business with the state to perform, you know, agreed upon contracted duties need to be paid according to the contract. And it seems to me that I know we probably have to take this action today to approve this item so the contractor can get paid. But you know, the next time you come up here with an item, we really would like to see if there isn't a way for us to get more than one bidder, number one, and we can have some actually competitively bid contracts. And we don't want to see another one that's retroactive after the fact. We like to approve things in advance. And so we want to, the next time you come up for us, I think we're going to have to move on this one for you. We don't want to do it again.
Yes, sir.
And so fifth time, sixth time is the charm. And but we want to see the next contract not retroactive, pays the vendor on time, and it's in accordance with the contract. Does that sound good?
Yes.
Thank you. Any other questions?
No. I totally agree with you.
Governor, you mentioned going back to 2014. This goes back before 2014. You and I spoke 5 years ago, five and a half years ago. It was just about exactly the same situation, only it was 50,000. Now it's 27,000 that we have stiffed someone for. That was the term that was used 5 years ago. Mr. Coleman, I don't understand. I know Baltimore City Community College is going under a lot of change. There are a lot of issues, bigger issues than this even. But I have a list here going back to 2008 of these retroactive contracts for which it was either said, oh, there's a problem in the process, or we've had turnover and it's a problem. And last time, the process was, I quote, a disconnect between the contract administration and actual processing of the bill, meaning we used the contract, they did the work, we didn't pay them. And now it's happened again. I don't understand it, because I know you don't think this is the way things should be done. I have great respect for your intentions, no question about it, but we are, as I said before, stiffing the people who do work for us. How does this stop?
Well, what we have done, as you correctly remember, yes, we did come to the meeting five and a half years ago. I also presented confidential information on the staff turnover that created the voids in our procedures. Since then, we have also had the same situation occur, except for the fact that our corrective action now is, rather than having decentralized licensing where departments have those licenses and are responsible for putting them into the procurement system, we now have them all centralized in our IT system as part of that inventory of software and software licensing. We're thinking that this will make it more effective. The issue with the sole source to the library, I'm sure you understand the proprietary relationship with the software, and always the evaluation as to, if I change, what will that cost benefit be? However, to satisfy the needs of the board and the procurement compliance, we wish to issue a solicitation to have competitive bids that will be in accord with the new advisory on one bid coming before the board. So we've done those things internally in a hope to avoid this embarrassment to the college in the future.
Do you think that the fact that nobody ever gets paid on time is discouraging bidders? I mean, we might end up with a no-bid contract instead of a sole-source contract. These guys might get tired of not getting paid and not going to bid.
I totally agree with you, Governor Hogan. And to that fact, I've also gone to the special secretary for the minority business governor's office and presented the proposal to them to help expedite the payment using the blanket PO and a payment off of the credit card, so therefore vendors would get paid in 3 days. However, as you know, well, at the college, our practice is that the invoices come into accounts payable. Yes, it's just inconceivable that a vendor would go along 2 years without submitting an invoice. I received a call from your office on yesterday, and just to verify, I went back 5 years in our FEMA system, and yes, there were POs cut, but they were closed out. I also looked at direct vouchers for the last 5 years. And over the period of the last 5 years, there were just two payments to this vendor, and that was in 2013. So how that this has gone under the radar with a vendor who can, it's inconceivable from the vendor standpoint, and it's, we can't get away from our responsibility to pay for the service.
So you forgot to pay, and they forgot to bug you about getting paid.
Well, something broke down.
Is there a penalty? Does the state agency incur a penalty?
No.
Would that help?
Well, that would go, my understanding, that would go against COMAR so far as the payment.
It does. Yeah.
It does. I thought the state agency paid late fees, but apparently the agency doesn't come out of the agency's, this agency's budget.
They're the ones that are late.
Would that attract
you? Maybe that would make people pay more tax.
Yes. I'm sure.
Yeah. All right.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
You.
Appreciate you coming and answering our questions. I don't have any other questions. Anybody else? Is there a motion?
Move approval.
Second. 3-0. Last but not least, no, we've got a couple more. We got transportation. Mr. Secretary.
Good afternoon, members of the board. For the record, I'm Pete Ron, Secretary of the Maryland Department of Transportation. The department is presenting 11 items today, and I would just like to say to the governor, thank you very much for your expression of condolences yesterday to the people involved in that horrendous crash. Thank you for doing that.
Very sad, and our hearts go out to all the people that lost their lives, all the people that were injured, and their families and loved ones. We particularly lost two state employees. Not only one from your department, but another longtime employee from, I think, the Department of DHR. I mean, DHMH, 27-year state employee. And I understand that the female driver of the MTA bus, her husband was also a driver, driving another bus at the same time.
Yes.
It's just tragic, and please extend my personal condolences to this folks.
I will. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Motion on transportation?
Move approval.
Second. 3-0. Last, we got DGS. Secretary, good morning.
Good morning, Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr.
I want to just interrupt for 1 second, say I went with the Secretary of DGS and his wife, who's our press secretary, to Disney on Ice over the weekend with his four-year-old daughter, Isabella, and my three-year-old granddaughter, and we had an awesome time. We met Mickey and Minnie.
My daughter loves Uncle Governor.
Uncle Governor. I like that.
For the record, I'm Ellington Churchill, Secretary of General Services. The department has six items on today's agenda, and we'll be glad to answer questions at this time.
I have no questions. Any questions?
No.
Motion? Move. Second. 3-0. Thank you, everyone, for being here. This session of the Board of Public Works is now adjourned.